This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. With its wormholes, black holes, and tesseracts, the sci-fi movie Interstellar can seem like an astrophysicist's wildest dream come true. And in a way, it really is. Way before the $100 million budget, Oscar buzz, and premieres, Interstellar was just a cosmic glimmer in the eye of theoretical physicist Kip Thorne. He had an idea for a science fiction story set on science's furthest frontier, a place of bulk beings, brains, black holes, and time warps. Nearly a decade later, director Christopher Nolan has taken that initial idea and blasted it into a higher dimension. Interstellar, as Kip has said, is a thrilling mix of science fact, educated guesswork, and wild speculation. And here to tell us how it all came together are the collaborators themselves. Christopher Nolan co-wrote, produced, and directed Interstellar. His previous films include Memento, Inception, and the Dark Knight trilogy. Christopher Nolan, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Kip Thorne is a theoretical physicist and an executive producer and science advisor for Interstellar. He's also author of the book The Science of Interstellar. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
And before we start, that's our spoiler alert. Oh, yeah, our goal is to go where no interstellar interview has gone before, and we will be talking about events later in the film that are in the film, might be spoilers for you. So if you want to see the movie first, catch us on the podcast after you've seen the film. Kip, what was the seed idea that started all of this? Did you have a story in mind back then?
Well, back then is a long time ago, 2006. The vision was to do a movie that in which the science was embedded into the fabric of the movie from the outset, and the movie was set on what I'd like to call the warped side of the universe, that is, objects and phenomena made from warped space and time, black holes, wormholes, beings that inhabit higher dimensions, warped time. So that was the vision. Linda Obst and I, who started this thing way back then, had a story, but Chris and his brother Jonah changed the story so radically over the years since then that it bears little resemblance to what Linda and I began with.
But kept the wormhole and the black hole.
Kept the wormhole. They kept the science, and there was a lot of additional science came out from Chris himself and from brainstorming with Chris and Jonah.
Yeah, well, you're still talking to one another, so I guess that you kept the gist of the feeling of
it. We did. We had a lot of fun doing it.
That's good. In your original story, did we meet the bulk beings and those higher dimensional beings we hear about in the movie but we never get to see?
Yeah, we had the bulk beings there from the beginning. Chris made it much more subtle and I think much better in that respect.
And Chris, what attracted you to this project that— Kip was working on it for years. How did you get attracted to it?
Well, I'd been hearing about it from my brother, Jonah, who'd been working with Kip for years on it, for Steven Spielberg to direct originally. And there were a couple of things that I really loved about it. The first was this idea, this concentration on a family relationship, a father and his children. I'm a father myself, related to it very strongly. And it was the contrast between that intimate story and the idea of telling a science fiction story about a potential inevitability in mankind's evolution. This huge, momentous idea that one day mankind might have to live independently of the Earth, move out and reckon with our place in the wider universe. I really love the contrast of the intimate family relationship and the cosmic scale of that notion that mankind may well move out into the universe one day.
Mm-hmm. You've talked about the importance of your movies operating by a set of rules. Did you have a mm-hmm. set of rules for Interstellar?
We had a number of sets of rules. I mean, we had our sort of movie rules, if you like. The way that you try and introduce elements to the audience, the way you try and play fair with the audience. And then we had the laws of physics and science. And that was where, you know, the interaction with Kip came in, because when I first came on the project, I called my brother and I said, well, how does it work with Kip? Is he going to be the science police on the project? Is he going to tell me all the things I can't do and so forth? And Jonah said, no, it's a really fun collaboration, because what Kip brought to the table, what he had to offer, was the mind-blowing potential of real science versus what you could come up with, you know, as a screenwriter. And when you start looking at laws of relativity, the effects of, you know, black hole, what you could do passing through a wormhole, what that offers you in terms of story potential, those things become incredibly exciting. They come with a price, though, and the price is we have to try and keep honest about the science in the film. So we're inspired by the mind-blowing possibilities, and then we're trying to also wind up at a place where, you know, a physicist or whatever could see the film and could see that we, to the degree we could, respected the natural laws of the universe.
Kip, were those parts of your rules to keep the science real?
Well, I wouldn't say I was imposing rules in that respect, but I was encouraging guidelines. The guidelines that I had in mind from the outset were that nothing in the movie would violate well-established physical laws, and all the wild speculations, and there are a few in this film, mm-hmm. they would spring from science.
You said reasonable speculation in your book, actually, not wild speculation. Let's be fair.
Well, you know, Margaret Atwood, who many call a science fiction writer, she refuses to call herself a science fiction writer because she says, I'm not talking about fiction. This stuff could happen. Do you sort of feel the same way about your way of looking at the science in this movie?
Well, in this movie, there's well-established science, and there's also speculative science. Much of the movie deals with physics that is beyond the frontiers of firm knowledge. That includes the wormholes, for example, and the higher dimensions, the fifth dimension. And in those domains, however, we know enough to be able to lay down some guidelines. But there's a huge amount of freedom because we really don't have a mastery of what goes on in those areas. Mm-hmm. Chris took beautiful advantage of that freedom. The issue of whether you can go backward in time, we don't have a firm answer to that. And so Chris laid down his own rule set for that almost from the outset of our conversations, a rule set that I really like, that nothing physical like a human being can go backward in time. But gravity, which we are pretty sure can reach across dimensions, reach across the fifth dimension, Chris laid down a rule that allowed that you could send gravitational signals backward in time or backward relative to time here in our universe, in our four dimensions.
You know, there's this old science fiction debate about time travel, that if you go back in time, if you change anything, you're going to change whether you're there or not. You know, will you change history over that period of time? Chris, was that a rule that you thought about at all?
Well, yes and no. The answer to that's complicated. And the reason is our version of, Interstellar is not a time travel movie per se. And Kip was sort of explaining that. It's about dimensionality and it's about viewing our universe from higher dimensions. And essentially what I proposed to Kip when I came onto the project and what we agreed upon with the rules of physics and they're outlined beautifully in your book, but is to say we're viewing time as a spatial dimension when viewed from a higher dimension, when viewed from the fifth dimension, it becomes the fourth spatial dimension at points in our story. And so essentially what we're saying is that the way we experience time is an artifact of higher dimensions existing that we can't experience. And if we accept that idea, then we have to accept the idea of cause and effect as an artifact of the way we experience time rather than an absolute truth. And so when you're able to view the four dimensions we live in, time being one of them, from a fifth dimension, the entire notion of cause and effect has to be completely readdressed in ways that we have no capacity to analyze, really. There's a line in the film where Anne Hathaway's character says, talking about the way time might look to a fifth-dimensional creature. She says to them, the past might be a canyon we can climb down into. The future might be a mountain we could climb up. And that's really there to try and clue the audience into this notion we're playing around with here of looking at our four dimensions from a fifth dimension and what that might mean. And certainly when you get into the arena of cause and effect, which is a classic paradox of time travel movies, I think we actually don't deal with it. We considered it, but we actually sidestep it completely by saying, that's all about cause and effect, and cause and effect has to be completely readdressed if you're looking at our four dimensions from a fifth.
Kip, you said that there are science ideas in the film that people will think are yours that are actually Christopher's. Can you give us an example of that?
Well, I think the most beautiful example is the Tesseract, which occurs in the climax of the film. Chris told me early on that he wanted to use a Tesseract, and I was really thrilled with the idea because back when I was 13, I read a book by George Gamow, a physicist, in which he had a picture of a tesseract. A tesseract, by the way, is a four-dimensional cube. It's the analog of a cube in one higher space dimension. And I stared at this picture of this tesseract in that book for hours and trying to come to grips with it, trying to understand it. And that book and that picture probably were the greatest influence on me to become a theoretical physicist. And so I loved the idea. And what Chris did with that, it was really unique, the manner in which he developed the Tesseract in the concluding parts of the film.
It's interesting you say that about Gamow, because he was very influential in my interest in science. I didn't do a 1, 2, 3 infinity. My favorite was Mr. Tompkins' series in Relativity Land.
Yes.
You're familiar with that one?
Yes. That was great, too.
That was great.
See, I know the Tesseract idea, the concept from A Wrinkle in Time, Madeleine L'Engle.
I wondered if that was where it
Yeah, no, I mean, that was when I was the age you were describing, that was a very important book to me, and I puzzled over that notion a lot.
Did you think that you needed to bone up on physics and understanding time travel and relativity to be a good producer, writer, director in this film?
I felt, in all honesty, I felt like I couldn't delve too deep into it because as a director particularly, I have to be the audience for the film and the audience is not going to have that specialized knowledge. So obviously in my discussions with Kip, I had to stretch my brain as far as it would go to try and keep up with some of what he was talking about. But I also tried to put blinders on a little bit and look at the big picture. And you know, I tried to seize on the things that really spoke to me in an obvious way. A good example of that would be when Kip was describing to me the way a wormhole would seem in space if you could actually approach it, if you could actually try and fly a spaceship through it. And at some point in what he was saying, I realized, I was like, wait, Kip, you're saying it's a sphere, not a circle. And he said, of course it is. You know, it's a three-dimensional hole. You know, in it's a hole in three-dimensional space-time, so it's a three-dimensional hole. And I try to seize on that and say that, to me, that's a mind-blowing concept, the idea of a three-dimensional hole. And I think I can portray that in a film in a way the audience will understand. And so I tried to sort of keep a layman's attitude towards the science and what was exciting about the science. And in fact, I sort of put that scene that happened between us more or less in the film. Exactly.
Well, I noticed that. You almost made it like an aha moment in the film, right? Hey, look, it's a sphere.
Well, it was for me.
Yeah.
It was for me. I just thought, you know, I thought I knew a bit about, you know, what a wormhole was and how it would look and everything. And I suddenly found myself realizing that's something I've never seen before. I've never seen anyone explain the idea that it's a three-dimensional hole. And this is kind of stuff that somebody like Kip knows in his bones. He knows from his experience. But for the rest of us, you know, if you can find something as tactile as that, where you say, here's a hole that I can approach from any side, I can fly around it, and then I can and drop into it from any angle, that's a really amazing thing to try and experience in a film.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Did you think that one of your roles in making the movie was to sort of be a popularizer of science here by pointing out things like this?
Absolutely. I mean, I just, you know, I grew up in an era of great excitement about science fiction and science, I think, deriving from the excitement about science fiction. I was 7 years old when the first Star Wars came out. Carl Sagan's Cosmos came on screen, you know, I was about 10 years old. And these were things that were so exciting to me as a kid. And most of what I know about any of this is from that age, from studying those things, because we were, my friends and I, you know, we were all excited about it. I feel like if Interstellar can, you know, interest kids today and in some of the ways in which I was influenced by popular culture at the time, I think that would be really exciting.
I want to play a clip on that theme. You did a good segue for me. I want to play a clip from the movie. It's the future, and the main character, Cooper, has just discovered that his daughter's teacher doesn't believe in the Apollo missions.
You don't believe we went to the moon?
I believe it was a brilliant piece of propaganda that the Soviets bankrupted themselves, pouring resources into rockets and other useless machines.
Useless machines.
And if we don't want a repeat of the excess and wastefulness of the 20th century, then we need to teach our kids about this planet, not tales of leaving it.
You know, one of those useless machines they used to make was called an MRI. And if we had any of those left, the doctors would have been able to find the cyst in my wife's brain before she died instead of afterwards.
Wow. Was that a dig at Congress? People who fund science or don't understand the importance of science?
That came about, it was in Jonah's original draft, and I know exactly where it came from, because it came from the experience of being in Hong Kong, myself, Jonah, my DP on The Dark Knight, Wally Pfister. We went to an Omnimax theater, and we watched the great Tom Hanks Omnimax IMAX film about the moon landings, and it was terrific and made out of this real love for the subject. But there was a point in this 40-minute film where they felt they had to address the idea that maybe the moon landings had been faked. And we found this really depressing. I mean, the idea that they would even have to dignify that kind of nonsense with analysis of any kind, we found really profoundly disturbing, because we've sort of felt this in the culture, you know, this kind of skepticism, this kind of cynicism about the great achievements of the past, and the moon landings being, you know, one of humanity's most spectacular achievements. So to feel that creeping in, I know that the Jonah felt very strongly that he needed to get it in the film and, you know, allow it to be a symbol of our inward-looking nature over the last couple decades. We've had all kinds of extraordinary technical progress, but it's really been aimed at communications, things in our living room, you know, cell phones, all this sort of stuff. And it feels to us like it's time to start looking outwards again and get in touch with that sense of curiosity that's always driven human exploration.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour with director Christopher Nolan, physicist Kip Thorne about their film, the new galaxy-hopping epic Interstellar. Christopher Nolan co-wrote, produced, and directed it. His previous films include Memento, Inception, and The Dark Knight Trilogy. Kip Thorne is a theoretical physicist, an executive producer, and science advisor for Interstellar. His new book is The Science of Interstellar, which is really heavy reading, but really interesting.
It's not that heavy, is it?
I love the beauty in the details. The beauty is in the detail. Let's talk about one of the non-human stars of the film. And that is the black hole that's in the film. We've heard by now that you say you've discovered some cute details, as you put it, about black holes working on the movie. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, so we should maybe go back. And Chris called me back in May and said, I'm going to send a guy over to your house to talk to you about the visualization of the black hole and the wormhole. So the guy came over. It turned out to be Paul Franklin, who got the Academy Award for the visual effects in Chris's movie Inception. And I wound up working very closely with Chris and members of his team at Double Negative in London. I fed them equations that described the propagation of light beams around black holes through wormholes so that they could use that to see what things would look like to a camera that's orbiting a black hole or traveling around or through a wormhole. And that software that they wrote is very, very powerful. They use techniques for creating these visualizations that because they have to do IMAX resolution with, I'm told, 23 million pixels. Is that right?
It's a lot of pixels.
It's a lot of pixels for one picture.
Yeah, a lot of pixels. No, and I think, I mean, for me, the biggest surprise was the way the disk around the black hole would curve up and around it. Like I found that really amazing and just, you know, like something I never imagined.
And that came right out of the simulations. I didn't tell them that would happen.
So you didn't really know what the picture would look like itself.
I had forgotten it. So I had first seen that many years ago. Jean-Pierre Lumet in France did a visualization in black and white, little stippled drawing. It was a lovely surprise. And so that black hole in the film is really compelling.
Well, what I loved about the accretion disk and the way the gravitational lensing brings it up and around from the back is it makes it look like a three-dimensional object. So it's back to this idea that we've first explored in the wormhole of the spherical hole. I just find the idea that the black hole is a sphere, that to me is very exciting.
And Kip, so what were the fine details, the cute details, as you put it, that you discovered?
So we now have the software tool for visualizing things with gravitational lensing, light beams in curved space-time. And it turns out that with the black hole spinning very, very fast, near the edge of the black hole that is moving toward you, we see a surprising, very interesting, beautiful pattern of stars. And we can watch as new images suddenly appear in pairs, pull apart, and then one of the images that was thereby created finds another image and they annihilate each other. I mean, I've known that this could occur, but I've never seen it with such glorious beauty as we have in some of these film clips of
creation and
annihilation of pairs of stellar images.
When you write up the paper to describe this, do you give these CGI people some credit discovery?
We are trying to get this paper finished that we had promised would be out about the same time as the movie. It should be done in a few days. But it's co-authored between me and the three key people in the CGI team.
We'll look forward to it. Christopher, you said that the book Flatland was an inspiration. What's that book bring to Interstellar?
Flatland, to me, is so clear and I suppose intuitive be the word we keep coming back to. It makes you feel how it is that we might be simply unable to view certain things about our world because we're trapped in the dimensions we're trapped in. You know, the author does it through analogy, and you know, there's a wonderful bit where he's, you know, the two-dimensional creature goes into a one-dimensional world and starts trying to talk to the one-dimensional creature, and then a three-dimensional creature comes into a two-dimensional world, and so it makes it very easy for your mind to then start thinking, okay, well, you know, if we're living in a three or four-dimensional world, what happens when a fifth-dimensional creature interacts with us? What would that be like? And that sort of infused really a lot of different things in the film, particularly in the third act.
Kip, you met with some of the actors. Tell us what that experience was like. I know from dealing with actors in my own experience, some really are into what you're talking about and they have to be dragged away, and some of them just couldn't care less about what's happening. What was your experience?
Well, I had close interactions with all four of the major stars. Spent 2 hours in a boutique hotel with Matthew McConaughey. It was one of the most interesting conversations I've had in years. He's intellectually curious. He was trying to get into the role of Cooper, trying to understand the science in the film. But it was a conversation that ranged over other things from family to where do you get ideas, how do you get how do you get inspiration. I had an hour and a half conversation with Anne Hathaway. She characterized herself as a physics geek and then asked me almost right off the bat, is there any experimental evidence for quantum gravity? And we went on from there. I was blown away. Toward the end, we talked about jazz and music, and I played sax in high school. I think she played the trumpet, as I recall.
I think one of the most surprising characters in your film is Tars, your robot. Mm. And the surprising part is how rudimentary, simple, and flat he is. Whereas today, you know, the trend in robotics is to make robots look as human as possible. You went in the totally opposite direction.
Yeah, I mean, we did, because I think these things change over time. And I think the idea that, you know, an automaton or an articulated machine is what I referred to it as, because I didn't want to call it a robot because I knew everyone would imagine it as a person walking around. I wanted the crew to get their heads around. It's a piece of equipment like a camera dolly or a mic stand or something. And so it should have the most utilitarian form possible. And my feeling was that human beings are so good at anthropomorphizing machines that even if we didn't give it a face, we didn't give it arms and legs, by giving it a voice and having a great actor, in this case it was Bill Irwin, the great Bill Irwin, who would puppeteer the thing on set as well as doing the voice. So it's a complete performance that the actors could interact with on set. They could improvise, you know, what have you. That we're so good at assigning human characteristics to inanimate objects that even without a face and an obvious human appearance, you start to feel for this character. You start to feel for Tarz as an entity.
And one of the human characteristics, obviously, that you felt was very important was a sense of humor.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even in my brother's earliest drafts, Tarz was always the source of a lot of the humor. He's very much the comic relief, and that's part of his mission. You know, part of his job on the ship is to be tuned to assist the morale of the crew in a very precise and exact way, because he's not subject to emotional frustration of long interstellar travel the way the crew would be.
This film allows itself, obviously, for a follow-up. Is it too early to talk about a follow-up to the film?
definitely too early to talk about that. I do one movie at a time. Even when we did the Dark Knight trilogy, we were very much doing one movie at a time and not worrying about what's next until it was, you know, fully out there to the audience, out on home video, all that stuff, you know, and then I'll wake up and figure out what to do next.
I have one more question to ask you. It's because I'm such a Star Trek fan from back in the day of the original Star Trek. And I was watching the film and suddenly a fist fight breaks out on a foreign planet. And I'm saying, this is your paying to William Shatner. You know, in the back lot of all those Star Trek films, they had a fight.
Yeah, and their Cuban heels would disappear in the fight scenes. I don't know if you ever noticed that. Well, magically disappear and reappear.
Did you do this on purpose for that? So sort of a, you know, nod of the head to the old Captain Kirk, even out here? I think
there's definitely an element of that, because I grew up loving that original series the same way you did. I actually had a slightly different source in mind specifically for that scene, which was Eric von Stroheim's film Greed, one of the great silent films. And, you know, it has this extraordinary confrontation in Death Valley at the end of the film where you're sort of trying to say something about human nature, I guess, on a grand scale. But I think the Star Trek influence is definitely there as well.
All right. That's a great place to end it. Thank you, gentlemen. We've been talking with Christopher Nolan, who co-wrote, produced, and directed the new Interstellar. It's in theaters now. Kip Thorne, a theoretical physicist. He was a producer and advisor on the film. His new book is The Science of Interstellar. And just like 2001 Space Odyssey, which I saw when I was in college about four times, the more times you watch this movie, the better it gets. It's a great film to begin with, but you pick out all these other things because you know what the plot line is. All these little stuff pops out at you. So I recommend this highly. You can read an excerpt from Kip's book and see pictures of that black hole and the wormhole that we're talking about. They're on our website. It's sciencefriday.com/interstellar. Thank you, gentlemen, for taking time to be with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.